You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
This March marked the 50th anniversary of the landmark Supreme Court decision in Gideon v. Wainwright, which established the right to free representation in court for the poor. And today, 80% of criminal defendants are represented by public defenders. But a half century later, the original promise of that decision, adequate representation for all, still has not been fulfilled. In her latest book, Chasing Gideon, The Elusive Quest for Poor People's Justice, Karen Hupert reveals the shortfalls of an overstretched American public defender system using examples from cases in four states around the country. It's published by the New Press, and it brought Ms. Hupert, who is a journalism professor at Morgan State University and who also teaches writing at Johns Hopkins University, to our show in March. We are replaying that interview for you now on this Labor Day holiday. I began by asking her, is this what happened since Anthony Lewis's best-selling book, Gideon's Trumpet?
Yeah, well, when his book came out, and it was based on this 1963 landmark decision, people were really optimistic about the promise of this decision, and it seemed manageable at the time. But what's happened since then is the courts have just completely been swamped by changes in the law, such as the new mandatory minimum sentencing and all those sorts of things. They've really swamped the courts, and so it's become much harder to fund this system.
Well, for those listeners who didn't read the book or see the movie starring Henry Fonda, can you just give us a little description of Clarence Earl Gideon and the case Gideon versus Wainwright? What was he accused of, and how? What kind of lawyers did he have?
Well, he was accused of robbing a pool hall down in Pensacola, Florida, and he took some change from a jukebox, a bottle of wine, a couple of beers, supposedly. He was accused of that. And he went into court, and he was sort of a drifter, and he'd been through the system before. He'd served time before. And this time he said, I want a lawyer. And the judge said, you can't have one unless you can hire one. And he said, but I'm the Constitution requires you to provide me with an attorney. And the judge said, no, it doesn't. So he tried the case himself, and quite badly. He he didn't know how to go through the jury selection process. The judge has to kind of talk him through that. And then when he was found guilty, he wrote this, penciled letter to the Supreme Court asking that he be appointed an attorney.
Isn't there a saying in law circles that a man who represents himself has a fool for a client? But he had no choice in the matter.
No, he had no choice. And the laws are really complicated.
So his case reached the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. He obviously did a better job of writing these things, these requests. Was he retried after the Supreme Court's decision?
He was. And the Supreme Court made a kind of interesting decision to appoint this high-power lawyer named Abe Fortas to represent
him. Who later became a Supreme Court justice.
Yeah. So he or he was up for that. But he was really a powerful attorney at the time, very good. And arguing on the other side was a young man who'd never argued before the Supreme Court, Bruce Jacobs. And they really kind of tipped the scales with that. And Gideon, won that case. And then it was sent back to court. And he had an attorney this time and was found innocent.
Now, there were some places where there was a system of of public defenders, wasn't there? Mm-hmm. I think New York had public defenders at the time.
Yeah, several states had already begun to do this, in fact, about more than 20 a state attorney general signed an amicus brief on the side of Gideon saying that public defense should be mandated, that people are entitled to a lawyer and that the system doesn't work without one.
So after the decision, did every state wind up with some kind of public defender's office?
Every state has now required to have some kind of public defense, but the courts mandated that you had to provide an attorney, but they didn't provide any funding to do that.
Now, in the aftermath of Gideon versus Wainwright, were people defended better?
Yes. Fewer were incarcerated. And even within Florida, 2,000 prisoners had their cases retried. And the system sort of worked as long as there weren't so many people trying to go through it.
Well, what percentage of defendants were indigent at the time that Gideon was decided? And what's the number today?
Has stayed about the same, which is 80% of people qualify for a public defender today.
Although there are a lot more people who are asking for it.
Exactly.
Because we have a larger population.
Right.
And more people are arrested these days. What level of poverty qualifies someone for free legal aid?
Well, it depends state to state what they determine, and even it can depend county to county what counts as indigent. So it's very complicated, cobbled together sort of system.
And if you can't, make the cut, you're stuck in the same situation Gideon was. You have to represent yourself.
Yep.
And there was a recent op-ed piece in the New York Times that noted that it's far more likely for a poor person to be incarcerated today than it was in 1963 when Gideon versus Wainwright was decided. Why is that if people are getting legal representation?
Well, part of it is that number of crimes that someone can be arrested and prosecuted for has snowballed, mostly due to the drug laws and mandatory minimum sentencing. So people are arrested for so many more things now and dragged into court. And if you look at the numbers, 30 years ago, 300,000 people were incarcerated. You know, that number has skyrocketed to, 3 million, 6 million today. So it's really impacted the courts and the way justice gets delivered. And people are just encouraged to plead guilty.
And haven't laws limited defendants' rights since Gideon was decided?
Yes. There have been efforts to kind of restrict that and expand it. It keeps going back and forth. Like when the right to counsel attaches to someone who's been arrested has changed. And there's been efforts since then to try to expand Gideon for example, right now there's a conversation going on about civil Gideon, whether you're entitled to an attorney, even if your case isn't a criminal case.
But right now you're not.
No.
Is public defense worse in areas where large African-American populations live?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the, two of the states that I write about in the book. I write about Georgia and Louisiana, and the systemic problems there are disastrous. In Louisiana, for example, I wrote about a crisis in the public defense there in New Orleans, where most of the clients are African American, and a budget crisis there, $2 million short for the public defense office, meant that they laid off a third of the public defenders there.
And you tell the story of Greg Bright. Mm-hmm. In New Orleans. What was he accused of?
Greg Bright was accused of murder in the 70s and spent 27 years in jail for this crime that he didn't commit.
And what was his experience with his public defender?
His public defender was somebody who was working part-time and didn't call a single witness in his behalf. He didn't deliver an opening argument. He didn't deliver a closing argument. And it was two defendants in this murder trial. And the whole thing took place in under 2 hours, which, is insane when you think about what the stakes are.
Shouldn't a judge have objected?
Yeah, but it was business as usual in New Orleans at the time. And not dissimilar from what goes on down there today.
Well, what impact did Hurricane Katrina have on indigent defense in New Orleans?
Well, it basically, the whole system completely ground to a halt in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. And part of that, it's sort of a strange situation, but part of the bulk of their funding came from parking and traffic tickets. And in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, of course, cops were not giving out traffic tickets or parking tickets, and, you know, the residents of the city had fled. So they ran out of money completely, and the inmates from the jail who were waiting for trial were scattered to all corners of the state and even actually sent out to jails in other states. They lost track of even who was in their jails, what they were there for. They had no attorneys to defend them. I mean, it was a huge disaster.
Well, they don't have a public defender's office in New Orleans. So they, New York does, a nonprofit. There and many other places, when somebody can't afford a lawyer is just assigned to them? Or lawyers offer themselves for assignment?
In New Orleans, actually, they did have a public defender's office, and they have one now. But what happened was those lawyers were working part-time, and they were also taking private clients. So their private paying clients often took precedence, and the public defense office on the heels of Katrina, thanks to a lot of reformers down there, has been completely revamped.
Can someone like Greg Bright, who was wrongfully accused and got inadequate representation, sue the state?
Yes, and Greg Bright did receive, I can't remember the exact amount, but I want to say $120,000 or $130,000 for his wrongful incarceration.
How long was he in jail?
27 years, yeah.
If you think that you're being poorly represented, can a defendant have the right to ask for a different public defender?
No, it doesn't really work that way.
You're stuck with the person. You might get somebody pretty good, but you also might get somebody who you know is a dud, and that's just the way it is?
That's just the way it is. And in my book, I tried to write about both kinds of public defenders, because there are also a lot of really dedicated, hardworking public defenders, but then there's also people who are slackers or untrained. And also the biggest problem is that they're carrying these massive caseloads, 200, 400, 2,000 cases down in Florida.
But all over the country, increased drug arrests since 1963.
That's right.
What impact do you think the legalization of marijuana would have on the strain on the public defender system?
I think it would ease the burden tremendously for the public defenders, since so many of their clients have drug-related arrests. Yeah, I mean, that would significantly decrease the problem.
What's been the role of the bail bonds lobby in this?
Well, the bail bonds lobby's role is connected to, you know, when someone's arrested in some states, and they just introduced this actually in Louisiana and New Orleans. You can have someone, you're sitting there pre-trial in New Orleans. You can be there for up to 4 months before the prosecutor even decides whether to charge you with a crime. You can get out if you can make bail. But what a lot of people now are saying is, like, why are we paying for people to sit in jail for nonviolent crimes? So there's been a big move to get people out pre-trial and get rid of this bail bond system, which basically says, you know, if you can afford it, you can get out. Well, that was never really the intent. The intent was to make sure people showed up when their trial was happening.
So the bail bonds lobby is fighting to keep these people in jail?
In a way, or at least fighting to make sure that if they get out, that they're paying them through this bail bond system.
My guest is Karen Hoopert, H-O-U-P-P-E-R-T. Her book, Chasing Gideon, The Elusive Quest for Poor People's Justice, is published by the New Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a break. Stay with us. Back with an interview I did in March with Karen Hoopert. Her book, Chasing Gideon, The Elusive Quest for Poor People's Justice, deals with 50 years of trying to make good on the promise of the indigent defense in Gideon versus Wainwright. I asked her, You talked about the public defenders having too heavy a caseload. Is that why we see so many plea bargains these days?
Yeah, because there's no way if a public defender is carrying, 400 cases, they can possibly take 400 cases in a year to trial.
Haven't many people who have been wrongfully convicted claimed that their public defender pressured them to take a plea bargain?
Yes, I think that that happens a lot. And the problem is that the public defenders don't really have a chance to investigate the case or really even spend much time with their clients before they advise them on what to do. You know, you'll go in any courtroom or courthouse in the country and you'll see these public defenders introducing themselves to their clients in the hallway 5 minutes before they go into court.
So how does that compare to the number of cases a public prosecutor might be assigned?
Well, there isn't a level playing field between the prosecutors and the public defenders, and that's one big problem. When I was writing about a case out in Washington State, the public defender had 101 cases and the prosecutor had 70-something. And the prosecutor's office also has the backup of all the police force to do their investigations and dig into the crimes and help them build a case and crime labs and all that. The public defenders are really strapped for all the support staff, too. So, if you have four investigators for 4,000 cases, as was recently described in the New York Times, that really makes it impossible for them to do a good job.
But we often hear about a glut of lawyers in this country and that law school graduates are having a difficult time finding jobs. Are public defender offices not hiring?
Well, they're strapped for cash, and they don't pay the big salaries that I think a lot of law students want to get when they get out of school. Plus, in the law school students' defense, they're carrying these huge loans, too, these student loans. And public defenders don't get paid very much.
A listener wrote that the public defender program is fed by the surplus of lawyers who are unable to get jobs with firms rather than the ones who might very well be idealistic and have graduated at the top of their class.
I think it's a mix, actually, because I met quite a few really idealistic public defenders out there who had a real fire under them. One of them out in Washington State that I wrote about, Carol D. Hunneke, really went to bat for her clients. And what happens, though, I think, is that they get burnt out because the workload is so intense. So even though they may enter young and bright-eyed and idealistic, the system wears them down.
I want to talk about that case, the case of Sean Replogle, in just a moment. But sticking to the problem of getting more people to work as public defenders, there have been reports that public defender offices in New York State have to put their employees on furlough as a result of sequestration.
Mm-hmm.
Is this happening around the country?
Yeah, and that's going to, make all of the problems that already exist much worse. And that's predating sequestration. That's what happened down in Louisiana, was that they were forced to lay off a third of their public defenders down there because of budget constraints.
Now, we were talking about somebody in New Orleans who eventually got out. But what about other people who might have been convicted at the same time? Are other wrongfully accused people likely to be sitting in prisons right now?
Absolutely. And even down in Louisiana right now, I talked to a guy who'd been sitting in jail for 16 months and didn't have an attorney assigned to him. So it's and I think that the more that innocence projects bring to light these miscarriages of justice, the more we understand that the system is not fail-safe.
Has the recession increased the number of people in need of public defenders?
Yeah, it has, because as people, you know the unemployment rates and all that sort of thing. So more people are definitely qualifying for public defenders as well.
According to the World Justice Project, the United States ranks 66th out of 98 countries in access to and affordability of civil legal services. And you said that civil cases are not covered by Gideon versus Wainwright. So if some states start covering the civil cases, are we just going to see more of a problem in an odd way because public defenders will be even more overworked?
Well, it's going to cost more, that's for sure. And that's where the pushback's coming from, is that do states or counties want to assume responsibility for paying for, legal aid attorneys to stand beside somebody in a civil suit? So, yeah, there's going to be a lot of pushback about that.
Now, you cover four defendants in your book. Is there anything particular about the justice systems in the four states that they were convicted in?
What do you mean exactly?
Did you pick these four for specific reasons? Or?
Oh, yeah. I picked these four people because I was looking for defendants who are going through the system whose cases exemplified systemic problems in these various states.
Well, we think of Washington State as a relatively enlightened state. But one of the cases, as you mentioned, was about Sean Rapogle. Is that his name?
Mm-hmm.
What was he accused of?
Sean Rapogle was a 18-year-old who was accused of vehicular manslaughter because he was driving his first car home from cashing his paycheck and hit an old man who pulled out in front of him. And he was uninsured. He was actually getting his paycheck cashed in order to pay for the insurance. The other driver, an elderly man, was actually at fault because he pulled in front of him and Sean had the right of way. But the old man was taken to the hospital, and about 2 weeks later, he died. And out in Washington, this public defender, Carol D. Hunneke, represented Sean. And she had tried several cases in the last month before Sean's case was supposed to go to trial. And she went before the judge and she said, I need a little more time. I need another week to investigate this case. And the judge said no. And she decided that she was going to resist that this was ethically impossible for her to try this case, that it would be ineffective assistance of counsel. And so she basically refused. And the judge ultimately granted her the extra time to work on the case. And it turned out in the end that the elderly gentleman had gone into the hospital, but in the course of, doing some tests, they discovered he had a hernia and had operated on his hernia, which was a pre-existing condition in which his own doctor had said, I'm not going to operate on this man because he's too fragile.
But if it had been business as usual, none of this would have turned up, and Sean would have wound up in jail for involuntary manslaughter.
That's right. And Sean is, an 18-year-old kid who had no prior record, nothing, not even gotten in a fight in his life, nothing. So, you can see that that for people who are going through the system, the stakes are so high. And I think we forget about that sometimes.
My guest is Karen Hupert. Her book, Chasing Gideon, The Elusive Quest for Poor People's Justice, is published by the New Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. After Sean's case brought attention to indigent defense shortfalls in Washington State, an investigative report uncovered the story of Tom Earle. Who is he?
Yeah, Tom Earle was a public defender that had run into all kinds of or had begun to do all kinds of sneaky practices out there in Grant County. And at the same time as Sean's case was going through the system, there was another kid in that same county who was going, Grant County in Washington, who was a 12-year-old kid who was accused of child molestation because a 5-year-old neighbor boy said he put his hands down his pants. And I write about that case partly because it provides a good foil in some ways to what the other public defender, Carol D. Hunneke, was doing with Sean.
But Tom Earle was kind of like those Medicare doctors who falsely claim having done work that they didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
They're beating the system. Is it because these guys are hired on an hourly basis? They're not really working out of a public defender's office?
Yes, that's a huge problem in a lot of counties across the country. public defenders are paid a flat fee. So $162,000 to handle however many cases get thrown their way.
So in that case of the child molestation, the defender only spent an hour with the defendant.
Yeah, he spent very little time. I actually think it was about an hour and a half total with this kid. And he didn't make a single call on behalf of his client. He didn't hire an investigator to do any work. He didn't do any background checks, filed no motions, no requests for discovery. He just told the boy's parents that their son should plead guilty and handed them, you know, a very complicated legal document to read really quickly and then sent the kid into court to plead guilty.
A 12-year-old kid.
A 12-year-old kid.
Who was then sent to some kind of reform school?
Well, he was sentenced to 4 to 9 months in custody. He actually didn't end up having to serve that because they appealed it, but he was forced to undergo HIV testing, and he would be – this would be permanently on his record that he had to register as a sex offender no matter where he went for the rest of his life.
A listener, Mark in Bronx, who's a former judicial law clerk, called in to say that the fact that there are so many plea bargains is usually the result of pressure from judges. And in a number of the stories you've told, it sounds to me like judges are as culpable as some of these as the system itself, overzealous prosecutors, and bad defense attorneys.
Yeah, that's true. And judges, you know, kind of the culture of the courts is such that if you can clear your docket, it's all about, like, how fast can you get through the system? How efficient can you be? And pleas are much more efficient than any trial.
The final case you look at involves Rodney Young. What happened in that case?
Rodney Young was a young man from New Jersey who was accused of murdering his girlfriend down in Georgia. So he was extradited down to Georgia. And I write about that case. I wanted to have a death penalty case in there, and I also wanted to have a case that was happening right now, that was currently going through the system, so that it was an ancient history. You know, this was a few months ago. And Rodney Young had been, you know, in special ed his entire life. He worked in a canning factory putting labels on cans. And his lawyers were arguing that he was mentally retarded and therefore could not be subject to the death penalty. The jury decided that wasn't the case. But his public defenders, who were incredibly devoted, also had quite a few cases on their desk. And more importantly, the way it was funded there was they didn't really feel like they were able to call in the experts that they wanted and to do the kind of traveling to interview that they needed to do to really build a solid case.
Bringing expert witnesses costs money.
It costs a lot of money. And to get the really good ones, you have to book them months and months in advance. And in Georgia, they're kind of triaging cases at the Capital Defense Project.
There was also the aspect of a jury deciding this case in Georgia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was interesting because the defendant, Rodney Young, was a black man. The county in which he was tried is about 50% black, 50% white. And yet there were only two black jurors. And that was curious to me.
Well, that's something that defense attorneys can try to rectify, can't they?
They can try. But what happens is when you're being selected to serve on a jury, especially a death penalty jury, there's this set of questions that actually ends up disqualifying a lot of African Americans from serving on the jury, partly because the number of African Americans who oppose the death penalty is higher than the white population. So they ask this question, are you comfortable, you know, giving the death penalty? And a lot of African Americans say no.
Now, the public defender's offices are in a state-by-state, sometimes a municipal situation. Why doesn't the federal government play a larger role in enforcing Gideon's promise? After all, this was a decision of the U.S. Supreme Court.
That is the hope of reformers right now, is that the federal government will really step in to enforce people's constitutional rights. And Senator Leahy just last week introduced some legislation. I think it's called the Gideon's Promise Act. And what that would do would be to basically get the federal government to behave the same way they might with highway money. In other words, you get this money if you meet these requirements.
Now, are there different rules for federal cases?
In terms of public defense, the federal public defender system is actually considered quite good. Caseloads are limited. The resources are there. Same with Washington, D.C.'s public defender's office. That's considered sort of gold standard. So there are systems out there that work. They know how to make this happen. But it is going to require some money to beef up the system and create some kind of fairness or parity between prosecutors and public defenders.
Karen Hooperd teaches in the MA in writing program at Johns Hopkins University and is on the journalism faculty at Morgan State University. Her book, Chasing Gideon, The Elusive Quest for Poor People's Justice, is published by the New Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.